Yes, yes.
I am on. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm not a sit on the cushion and talk guy, Dharma talk guy. I'm a move around and be in the body Dharma talk guy. And the topic is the artist is present. The artist is present. You are the artist, the artists. And the artist is present comes from the great performance artist Maria Abramović. Some of you may have seen the Netflix documentary about her. For those of you who don't know, Maria Abramović is a Serbian performance artist. And she did this incredible piece at the MoMA in New York in 2010, in which she sat in the gallery for 3 months, 8 hours a day, over 770-something hours, and welcome people. Welcome them to the table. She also dressed in this beautiful gown. But she didn't say anything. It was all about an energy exchange. And it was all about presence. The artist is present. So there's three different ways we can think about that, right? The artist is actually there, present for the work, which is kind of a revelation in contemporary art, because usually just their art is there. But she is the art. And for 40 years, she's been a body artist, using her body as the medium. The way the painters, you painters might be using paint, us writers are using words, and Maria uses her body. And so I kind of saw this as the death of art, and simultaneously the rebirth of art. Because what do you do after this as an artist? I mean, in my vision, the whole point of creativity and creating, whether through words or film or anything else, is to be present, to show up. And when you show up in that way, and that's the art, that's it. That's everything. And so it's this really beautiful culmination. And in the film, people just sit with her. It's just sitting. It's total Dharma practice, straight out of the book. Yet recontextualized, right? For a formal art, contemporary art audience. People who have no connection necessarily to Buddhism or mindfulness or presence or any of that stuff. And they would come and you could sit with her for I think about 15 minutes, maybe 20. Which seems about like that sort of minimum meditation period. And just be. And she saw it as this kind of energy exchange. Just being. What a revelation for visual art. And you'd see people bawling their eyes out. Quite a few people just crying. Nobody had sat with them to just be with them, just to be present and accept them in their totality. This is a radical act. It's a radical creative act. Certainly in the art world, but even in the personal world, our daily world, our family world, just to sit and accept this person in front of you for the totality of who they are in this moment. No agenda, no need, nothing to be different about them. It's kind of an act of love. So the artist is present. You are the artist. You are present. The moment is now. This retreat. It's funny, you know, when she was conceiving of the piece, I read that she said, as the idea came to her, she became extremely nauseous. And that's when she knew it was a great idea. And so many of you, when you first conceived of coming on this retreat, you might have felt nauseous at the thought of sitting for, I mean, you might have been delighted to, right? Of course, it's a time away, etc. But the point being that it takes courage to show up, to be present for your creativity, for your imagination, for who you really are in this moment. That takes courage. And a lot of times that makes us feel nauseous. It's vulnerable. I was also reading about Brené Brown recently, an interview with her, and she was talking about actually that very first, I don't know if it was her first, but that famous TED Talk of hers, TEDx Houston, I think it was, in which she was absolutely mortified after giving that talk. Mortified, like embarrassed, like, ooh. And she begged them not to send it out, to post it. And her husband was like, ah, don't worry, honey. Nobody's going to be interested in this anyways. 25, 30 million views later. And she talked about this very notion of, if I'm not mortified by a talk on some level, then it probably wasn't very good. And by mortified, I think she means vulnerable, in which there was some level of exposure, right? Some personal sense of vulnerability, of presence, of realness, right? And so this has always been a great lesson to me, as someone who, you know, used to feel nauseous a lot, many different situations, and was kind of scared of that whole vulnerability piece. And, you know, now I realize that this is stepping in to being the artist. The artist is present. The artist is here, now. There is no other time to be the artist. And the most amazing thing, one of the most amazing things for me about mindfulness and meditation is this mind-blowing realization that there is nothing else than now, than presence. You know, the brain is such an incredible projection device and such an incredible memory device, much of which is very useful. But it's so easy to get seduced into the past and into the present. I mean, into the future, sorry. I'm going to take you to the past a little bit this afternoon, my past, just to illustrate a little bit of a point. I want to tell you a story, and it's my story, but it's not about me. And this is resonant for all artists, I hope, because I'm not just a writer. As you will hear, I went to art school for photography and many other things. But let me not get ahead of myself and begin with this question as a preamble to the story. Who am I, this artist that's present, who is that? Really? Like, who am I really? Seriously, Albert, guy standing up here, giving Dharma talk at Spirit Rock, writer, blah, blah, blah. Is that who I am? One of my favorite quotes of all times comes from Nisargadatta Maharaj, the great Indian mystic. He's also a teacher to Jack and many other people, maybe Anna, you as well. And he said, I cannot tell what I am because words can describe only what I am not. I cannot tell what I am because words can describe only what I am not. Okay, so hold on to those pieces for a little bit. I grew up in suburban Connecticut to distant and alcoholic parents who really weren't up for parenting. And a couple things about them before I get to the not up for parenting part. They were great consumers of culture. We had books. I was telling my writers this morning, we had about 1,000 volumes of books all over the house. They were members of MoMA in New York. My dad was a pseudo kind of part-time architect. There were just books on dance and architecture and photography all over the house. And I didn't pay much attention to that when I was a kid, as you'll soon hear why. So they weren't really up for parenting, busy kind of consuming art and culture and having fabulous parties and traveling a lot. So they hired a governess, this Swiss-German woman named Miss Hetty. Now, remember the monster from the Beowulf myth? Grendel? That was Miss Hetty. That was totally Miss Hetty. The quote I remember from her was, "You should be ashamed of yourself." And so for much of my life, I was. I started drinking at age 12. By 19, I'm a committed binge drinker. The way some people are committed artists, I was a committed binge drinker. By 19, there I am at a party. It's my freshman year of college. And my girlfriend, Jane, she's just broken up with me. And we're at this house in Connecticut. My friends are all there from elementary school and high school and people I met from college. And we're just drinking and drinking and drinking and getting more and more just completely wasted. And I'm making more and more of a fool of myself until finally I get chased from the house. And I stumble out into the driveway and I pass out face down in the driveway. And nobody notices I'm gone, including my friend Mike. And at some point, Mike is just done. He's had enough of this party. It's like 3 in the morning. Jumps in the car, cranks up the CSN, and he backs right over me. And somehow he hears me screaming. He drags my bleeding body into the car, and he drives drunk to the hospital. And I wake up somehow alive after an alcoholic coma of some alarming level. And my parents are there to greet me at the hospital. And they're very disappointed. Son, we're very disappointed in you. More shame, more drinking. It's this cycle that continues. Until 2 years later, I'm in Colorado. And I've transferred to Colorado to go to undergrad school. And same thing. You'd think that would stop me from drinking, but no. Kind of went back to it, tried to stop, went back to it, more drinking, more chaos, until there's a night I wake up handcuffed to a hospital bed with no idea how I got there. This time, I'm arrested for assault and battery. That's a whole other story that you can read about in Beamish Boy. Eventually, I do get sober because the with law on one side and girlfriend threatening to leave on the other, time to get sober. And I actually woke up alive, and I realized I wasn't going to get a third chance. So I do get sober. I move to California to start anew, and I meet a new friend when I'm in California for a couple weeks, and he's in something called therapy, which is like a total revelation to me. I don't know what therapy is. And he's in this therapy group. He's very enthusiastic about this therapy group, so I'm new to the state, and I'm like, wow, therapy, okay, you're in this group, you look like you're in good shape. And, he's known me for all of 2 weeks, he's like, dude, you need therapy, definitely. Join my therapy group. So I joined his therapy group. Turns out, however, it is a psychedelic therapy cult. And I get sucked into the vortex of this crew. There's no boundaries. They're doing tons of illegal substances, also known as drugs. And eventually, you know, having sex with a select few. And it's kind of a nightmare. However, they did have these redeeming workshops that they would host at various remote areas throughout Northern California and Nevada. And there was one in which we actually did no substances whatsoever. And it was up on Mount Diablo in the East Bay. For those of you who aren't from around here, it's this, one of the highest peaks in the Bay Area. It's about 3,000-something feet, looming over the, I know what you call that, valley over there near Danville. Anyways, Mount Diablo. And so there we are. It's a men's circle this time. There's about 20 of us or so. And it's a Saturday night. And my teacher's there, my therapist, in quotes, therapist, not recommended. Anyways, he's there, and he's wearing like a black hood. And he's got these two henchmen guys I've never seen before on either side of him. And we're sitting around this fire. It's midnight on Saturday. And we've been through all these like extremely unpredictable and exhausting exercises, therapeutic exercises. So we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, these people are unpredictable. And quite frankly, they're scary. So there we are in this circle. And suddenly he busts out this colored paper. And he has us write down on these little pieces of colored paper all the things that mean the most to us in our lives, the most important people in our lives, the most important things and places and our favorite foods and our pets. And there we are. We're writing them down on this little piece of paper. And then we're crumpling them up. He says, crumple them up and throw them into the fire. And I'm getting very emotionally engaged in this and just like, and then there's this long silence. A little awkward, kind of like this. And then he looks across the circle right at me. And he says, you, any last words? And I'm like, oh. And he says, take him. And his henchmen guys get up, they jump up, they run over to me, they throw a bag on my head, they drop me in a burlap sack, they drag me out into the forest, and they tie me to a tree. And I'm absolutely terrified. I'm mortified. I'm screaming. And I'm the first one they've done this to. And I'm pretty convinced I'm going to die tied to this tree. They don't say anything. They go away. And I'm far enough away from the camp, I don't hear the fire. I don't hear any voices, nothing. All I hear is coyotes howling, owls shrieking, wild boar grunting. And I'm freaking out, and I'm just bawling my eyes out. And a half hour goes by, nothing. An hour, nothing. An hour and a half. And at some point, I'm like, oh, there's a heartbeat. Belly up, belly down. I'm still breathing. And suddenly, I just felt this like rush of gratitude for simply like being alive. This like energy just sort of swept up from the center of the earth and was just like whoop. And after all these images, my whole life flashing in front of me and disappearing, they kind of came back to me. And this wealth of gratitude just filled my heart. Totally filled my heart. And I vowed in that moment, I said, if I ever get untied from this tree, I'm going to give myself to creativity, to love, and to service. And I'm going to quit this psycho group. And I did. I did. I quit the psycho group. Now, at the time, I had been in graduate school in San Francisco at the Art Institute. And I was there as a photographer. And I studied photography as an undergrad at the University of Colorado. Made it through okay. And then I get to San Francisco, and I'm just like, whoa. What's this performance stuff? What's this painting stuff? What's this land art stuff? What's this film stuff? Here I was in the big city, and taking classes with Paul Koss, the famous conceptual artist, and photography was just sort of like, ooh, well, that's okay. But so I got totally immersed and distracted by all these other art forms and completely seduced by just creating randomly. And in the photography department, everything was segregated at that time at the Art Institute. So there were, the painters were down on Market Street. We never saw them. The photographers were kind of in this small cluster of studios over on Chestnut Street. And it was very insular, and everyone was doing black and white, and you know, you had a portfolio, and it was just, it was photography with a capital P. And then the sculptors were kind of down in the basement area sculpting, and God knows what. We didn't really see much of them. And so I was just getting completely enamored with all this other kind of art, all this other kind of creativity. But I was so lost and confused. And I just started making, like, random shit, honestly. I made an aluminum foil ball. I was sitting in my studio one day, and I finished my sandwich, and I just balled up this aluminum foil ball. I was like, wow, that's interesting. And Ann Hamilton and some other artists had been making balls, and I was like, oh, I'll make a ball. I'll make an art ball of aluminum foil. So I went down to the market, and I bought, like, 10 rolls of aluminum foil. And I just started building up my ball. And eventually my aluminum foil ball got like this big. I could barely fit it out of my apartment. But I squished it through the door and I rolled it down the street. And I took it to, I took it to Golden Gate Park and I plopped it on a wall and I took pictures of it. And then rolled it, you know, here and there. And God knows what I did with my aluminum foil ball. And then I was like, oh, wow, rocks, benches. I'll wrap rocks in duct tape, and I'll put them on a red bench in the forest. And so I did that, and we had a critique one time, and the critique went on for hours. And we were talking about my wrapped rocks and duct tape on a red bench in the forest. And I thought I was a genius. I was like, wow, I don't know what I did, but they're talking about it. So... But then my year-end review came, and all the photo teachers were like, so where's your portfolio? And so I go into the studio, and I stick these pictures of my aluminum foil ball on the wall and my pictures of my wrapped rocks and a big poem that was kind of not really a poem, but I blew it up really big on a white piece of paper so it looked weird. I stuck that on the wall. And they looked around, and they were very concerned. They were pacing back and forth. They were looking very disappointed, like my parents. And I ended up failing my year-end review. I failed in graduate art school. Isn't that devastating? How can you fail at art, right? How can you fail as an art student? I managed to do it. But I had a solution. It felt like they wouldn't have me in the photography department. So I transferred to the new genres department. And the new genres department consisted of this like completely crazy performance artist guy whose name I can't even remember anymore. And he sort of showed up to the year-end reviews and sort of didn't. And so I transferred and did some completely random oddball installation. And he was like, yeah, this looks good to me, man. I think you're good. Check. And so that's how I got out of graduate school. Okay, so, but while I was there, I met a man named Bill Berkson. Bill Berkson was the art historian on campus and an art writer. He wrote for Art News and Art in America. He was also a poet. And he, one night, he says to me, there's this poetry reading at the Cal Theater, you should go. I'm like, poetry? I don't even like poetry. I'm very busy with my aluminum foil ball, can't you see? I don't have time for poetry. He says, no, you should come. Check it out. And I was like, I don't really have anything going on. I'll go do it. So I go to the Cowell Theater, and it turns out it's the reading for the Norton Anthology of Postmodern American Poetry. And Bill is reading along with the host of just all-star cast at the Cowell Theater. And it's Diane DePrima and Lynn Hejenian and Alice Notley and Ron Padgett, all these incredible poets from all over the country. And Paul Hoover, who's the editor, reads this introduction at the very beginning of the reading. And he's reading a piece from the poet Jack Spicer, who's one of these great pre-Beats. He was a Berkeley Renaissance poet. And he wrote this piece called The Imaginary Elegies. And so Hoover reads from this piece, and he says, he quotes him, where he says, "The poet builds a castle on the moon made of dead skin and glass. The poet builds a castle on the moon made of dead skin and glass." And I just freaked. I had never heard such an amazing line, words. It just like got into my body. It just got into my viscera. And in that moment, I knew that's what I'm supposed to be doing. That's it. I want to have that kind of emotional resonance and power with language. This photography thing is cool. It's all right. But words, like being able to carry that emotional tenor, that's it. That's the real stuff. And I think that was the night that I became a poet. And I went on from there to do a little research on the California poets in the schools. Well, needless to say, I bought the anthology and read it from cover to cover. And I just sort of found my medium. And then went on to work with the California poets in the schools and then started one by one sending a poem out here and there. And it snowballed. And it turned into a creative life for me that had resonance and that had power and that had meaning. And so I share this story in order for you to come back and think about your story. So coming back to this quote, who am I? Am I my story? Particularly, the important question is, am I my stories of limitation? My stories of pain? My stories of doubt? Is that who I am? Really? Is that who I am? Am I my opinions about my story? Am I my beliefs? Is that who I am? Am I even this flesh and bone body that's going to grow old and die? Is that who I am? Remember the quote, "I cannot tell what I am because words can describe only what I'm not." So words can describe belief, idea, opinion, story. So if I'm not that, what am I? Who am I? I would say that I am that which makes my story possible. I am that which makes opinion possible. I am that which makes belief possible. Right? That's who you really are. And you really are. And you really are. And you. And you. And you. And you. That's who we really are. That field of possibility. I'm not my story. I am a field of possibility. The artist is present. Please rise. That's a command. Please rise. Not a command, it's an invitation. So put your hands on your chest, your heart, just for a moment. I am not my story. Repeat after me.
I am not my story.
I am a field of possibility.
I am a field of possibility.
Wow, that was kind of lame. Okay, one more time. I am not my story.
I am not my story.
I am a field of possibility.
I am a field of possibility.
All great things come in threes. I am not my story.
I am not my story.
I am a field of possibility.
I am a field of possibility.
Yes, you are. I bow to you in your field of possibility. The artist is present. And may you go forth and create beauty in your life, in your world, and on the rest of this retreat. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.